fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Strong local journalism is a cornerstone of democracy, encouraging political participation and improving the efficiency and decision-making of local and state government officials. Accurate, honest, and well-researched reporting fosters healthy debate, can prompt major societal change, and connects community members by providing context to the key issues of the day, telling stories of the human experience. Local and regional news coverage of government leaders and agencies, businesses, institutions, activists, and concerned citizens directly affects quality of life issues, ranging from education to the environment, from health and safety to economic growth. That coverage may be discomforting at times, but it is essential. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Local and regional news drives conversations, serves as a public record, and covers the news that's happening in your own backyard. At Wisconsin Public Radio, rural communities reporter Rob Menser speaks to people on the ground where they live, writing stories that resonate with readers and listeners on topics that can have an enormous impact on our lives. Today, Rob is here for a behind-the-headlines look at the stories that are getting the most attention right now. Rob, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Listeners with questions for our guests can call 800-780-9742. You can also email questions to route51@wpr.org. Before we get into the news headlines itself, I'd really like you to explain what a rural communities reporter does. What's the role?
Sure. So this was a new role, at least as a beat for WPR when I joined two and a half years ago. And the way I think about it is, I look at the challenges, but also the innovations and interesting stuff happening in the smaller communities in Wisconsin. So, there's a lot of attention paid to Milwaukee and Madison, and rightly so. There's like a lot of people there. But there are also a lot of small cities and small towns in Wisconsin that have a lot of interesting stories to be told. And so, we have a reporter who focuses on agriculture as sort of a business beat. And so I look at my beat, rural communities, as a little broader than that. It's about life in what the Southerners call outstate Wisconsin, and so that could be looking at economic sectors like tourism or like forestry that are big in the North Woods. It could be looking at interesting innovations or just fun cultural life outside of the big cities.
And rural communities face some pretty unique challenges in Wisconsin Rapids. I'm thinking of that, for example, the closure of the paper mill that happened. That had a ripple effect in the city that is still really being felt. It affected so many people. And I know there have been efforts by some lawmakers to step in with this so-called mill bill. It is one that Governor Tony Evers vetoed. What's in the bill? Where is it now? What's going on with that?
So it's like very unclear where it is now. The mill bill would have given $65 million in loans toward the purchase of two closed paper mills. The Verso mill in Wisconsin Rapids was by far the larger of the two, but there's a smaller mill in Park Falls that for a long time operated as Flambeau River Papers and is closed now. And really, I mean, the idea was focused on the Verso mill, which closed in early 2020. And there's a group of timber professionals who wanted to purchase that mill as a like nonprofit cooperative. And the idea would be to have local Wisconsin ownership of the mill that would then buy the timber that Northwoods, Wisconsin produces. And this is an idea that people got very excited about and saw a lot of potential for, but it now has seemingly been a victim to the state's politics. Republicans wanted to pay for these loans out of federal COVID stimulus money, so which, in other words, was sort of keep it out of the normal state budget, right? Governor Tony Evers, who's a Democrat, said that it was not clear that it was actually legal to use the funds that way. And he had an alternate plan to pay for the loans with state dollars. And so, you know, even if it had gone through, it's not totally clear that it would have been like a slam dunk. The cooperative would have purchased, the mill would have restarted it. Everybody would be, you know, flowers and light and happiness. It might not have worked. But like right now, it appears to be at quite a standstill because the Republicans passed a law that would have, or passed a bill that would have paid for it through COVID stimulus, and the governor vetoed it. And now it's a standoff.
So really, no movement on that in the immediate future that you can foresee.
Yeah. So then after the veto, there was an offer from a different a large corporation to buy the Verso mill. That offer is still on the table. Verso has not decided. That is another possible way that that mill might reopen. But it's very much a black box. I'll tell you, I've been asking, and it's hard to find out what, you know, is Verso going to actually take that offer or not. It would not have the sort of Wisconsin ownership and the sort of local ownership that some people were very excited about. But it could be another route to reopening that mill.
A big closure that people in this area were talking about quite a bit over the last few years was the Wausau Center Mall. Of course, it was in decline for a number of years. And of course, years ago, it was the epicenter of shopping. People from rural communities and in northern Wisconsin came to Wausau. This was a shopping hub right in downtown Wausau. And then things started to change over the years. Now, the Wausau Center has been torn down. It is nothing but a blank space, and there is some development for the future. You did a story about the mall that I'd like you to talk about a little bit.
Yeah, so this was absolutely one of the things I wanted to capture in that feature story was that, you know, in 1983, when that mall opened, it was the cutting edge for retail shopping. It was a point of pride to have a mall come to the community of Wausau. I dug up a book put out by Consumer Reports in 1986 that was about 50 inventions that fundamentally changed the way we live. And they were like air travel and the birth control pill and the disposable diaper and the shopping mall was one of them. And so, but that's the way it felt to people at that time, right? I mean, there's a lot of people probably listening who remember this, or, you know, certainly people who well remember the Wausau Center Mall and in its heyday. But like that was there, but it also is the world has changed a lot. And so I wanted to go back to that time. In fact, a fun thing I got to include just a little snippet of in my radio feature was this TV commercial from 1983. And I think we have a clip of it. I would like to, I feel like people should hear this promo for the Wausau Center Mall back when it was first opening.
Sure.
Get carried away. This Wednesday, the Wausau Center Mall opens with a burst of excitement. It's a new shopping center with colorful, sensational stores, a variety that seems endless, a fun place to shop. You'll find the things you like for the people you love in a bright, new atmosphere that will make your spirits soar. Get carried away. Grand opening is this Wednesday at the Wausau Center Mall.
Where you'll find shopping's fun.
Shopping's fun.
Oh, that is a great old commercial. And I'm sure it brings back a lot of memories for listeners. That was the place to be when I was growing up here and going to high school here. We'd walk to the mall and have French fries after school and walk around and look at boys. And that was what we did. But of course, things changed. And there was a lot of discussion in Wausau about what should happen next. Yes?
Right. Totally. And so, you know, it was, you know, it's a lot of things, right, that changed. There was the rise of big box stores in the 90s and early 2000s. So in Wausau, that took the form of the Rib Mountain corridor really getting developed. But like, again, and this is like one of the reasons why I wanted to do this story for the state network is this is like has happened in many communities. A lot of places have seen this type of sort of arc. And it's interesting, and it says something about the way our lives have changed. So there was the big box stores rise, now obviously online shopping, and the rise of Amazon.com, or you know, more recently, definitely ate away at the mall as a place to go. And I think also maybe just like it's just a in a way that's harder to quantify. It just became less of a the cool place to go for young people to go and look at boys and so on. But people talk about that. That's real. And so so I wanted to try to get at something about that rise and fall, that arc. But also, right, as you say, the city now is making plans for a different kind of public space there. So a public market, there's a possibly ambitious but very cool looking drawing of a pedestrian bridge, a sort of a serpentine bridge that would go down to the riverfront. And I think in some ways you can look at that as representing what we want now out of our public spaces. It's in the way that the shopping mall was the cutting edge, most desirable thing in the early 80s. This is sort of how we think about what we want our public spaces to be. I talked to WASA Mayor Katie Rosenberg about the process that the city has gone through to try to make that a reality.
Big projects like this aren't just like this linear fashion sometimes. I mean, obviously, this has been talked about since, gosh, my dad was on city council. They were talking about this. So sometimes you just have to, ask the questions. You have to be prepared. You have to have the analysis, but you also just have to like hold your breath and jump sometimes and really hope that you're guiding it in the right direction.
That was WASA Mayor Katie Rosenberg, her comments on development plans for downtown WASA, which will change. And speaking of change, a lot of people say that the fall of the mall was really kind of a result of the shift to online shopping. People are buying online more and more every day. But I have to wonder what it's like for people in rural Wisconsin, because the broadband issue there is still a problem. The most recent report I read, 400,000 Wisconsin residents, mostly rural, without access to broadband. In fact, I was telling a young man about this the other day, and he was flabbergasted that there were areas of Wisconsin where you couldn't get high-speed internet. He had no idea. And, but because to us, it's, if we live in the city, it's such a given. But what's going on with the broadband effort and renewed push to get to those homes?
You know, I have been covering this issue since the day I moved to WASA, more or less, right? I bet you have too, right?
Yes.
For how many years has this been a discussion? And one thing I think about is there used to be an actual contingent in this debate whose view was that people moved to rural areas because they didn't want internet. Like that was a thing. I sat in the editorial board room in the WASA Daily Herald and heard people make that argument. And so I think that just doesn't exist anymore.
Well, maybe it did. Maybe it did years ago.
Yeah.
But not
maybe so.
Now.
Maybe so. Right. But it's a that I see that as a measure of how the shape of the debate has changed, because I think most people do recognize now that the way the world is now, you kind of do need connectivity to participate in. There's like a lot of the economy that works that way, the culture itself, right? There's like a lot of, you know, you'd find out a lot of stuff on the internet.
And, Not to mention, the pandemic made it essential for students,
exactly,
for workers who are working from home. So there was that really shed some light on that issue.
No, 100%. And so where it stands is, I think the governor proposed a $200 million for broadband expansion in his budget. The budget that Republicans ultimately passed and Evers signed included $125 million. That is a lot of money. You will note that it is less than the $1.4 billion that is estimated. So is it getting better? I guess yes. The governor also separately announced in May that he would use $100 million in federal COVID stimulus money on internet expansion. That is a part of it too. So, like, are we making headway? Yes. Are we done, or is it imminent? No.
Long way to go. Wisconsin Public Radio Rural Communities reporter Rob Menser is our guest today as we unpack the news stories that are having the most impact right now in North Central Wisconsin. Your questions and comments are welcome. You can call us at 800-780-9742 or email Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Rob Menser, rural communities reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio, is our guest today for a behind-the-scenes look at the news and a discussion on what listeners and readers are finding most compelling today. What would you like to know? You can email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. As much as we would like to forget that COVID-19 exists, and boy, wouldn't we ever, we are still in the midst of a pandemic. School started for most students in Wisconsin this week. What are some of the conversations about school safety and COVID protocols that you've been hearing about?
Sure. I think it is safe to say that that schools are the locus of COVID-19 discussions right now, because it is a new set of gatherings that did not exist last week that started this week. And so we have seen discussions across the state about masking policies, whether masks ought to be required or only recommended for kids attending school. There are some, you know, WPR had a story yesterday about in districts that are offering rural or rather virtual options, they are seeing increased enrollment in those. Certainly not as much as when all school was virtual, but maybe more than you might think. And I think that's a measure of people who have concerns about safety in school. And it's just like a very hot issue. You've seen this, Shereen. I know that's true in Wausau, and it's true, honestly, like in many, many communities in the state where people are really mad about whatever schools choose to do.
Yes, there are people who are angry no matter what. I know in Wausau, they chose a mask optional policy for fall. There is a petition with more than 900 signatures that has been circulating, asking them to reconsider. And then the DPI this week sent out an email or a memo to schools, kind of cautioning them that if they choose not to institute a mask mandate, they may face legal challenges. That's very interesting. And I know that some schools have then changed course.
It is interesting. And the I think my understanding of the idea is that there are some students who are immunosuppressed and may be vulnerable. And if the district does not take, if districts do not take reasonable precautions, that there could be a legal argument that they're not in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I don't know where that's going to go. I do know that not a lot of districts seem to have taken immediate action as a result of that letter. There are districts that are making changes. Appleton and Green Bay both reversed course, made masks required to start the school year after having had an optional policy. You know, the Tomahawk School District went the other way. They had said that masks would be required to start the school year, and there was an outcry in that community, and they reversed course there. Of course, I think that it's important to get, like, let's get the facts out, right? So children who are under 12 years old are not eligible to be vaccinated. So in public health circles, there is a a reasonable thought that unvaccinated people are a focus of concern, right? And there, it is possible for children to contract and spread COVID-19. We also know and have known since the beginning of this that children are less likely than adults and much less likely than older adults to have serious complications from the disease. And that plays into this sort of matrix of difficult decisions as well.
How are vaccination rates going in the state, especially in rural areas? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it really is different in different places, right? So there are rural areas in Wisconsin that have the lowest vaccination rates in the state. Taylor County, some others that are quite low. But it's not everywhere, right? So, Vilas County, Oneida County, they have a higher vaccination rate than Milwaukee County. Bayfield County, Door County, both have a couple of the higher vaccination rates in the state. And those are pretty rural communities. In Marathon County, where we are sitting now, we're at around 50%, a little less than the statewide average or total, but not too much less. And so it's a mixed bag. I think it's fair to say it's a mixed bag. Rural communities have some challenges in that we've seen surveys that the single demographic group who is most hesitant to get the vaccine are conservative men, and rural communities have a lot of those, a lot of conservative men, right? And so that is a challenge to getting those communities' vaccination rates up. But it's not a simple story. It's not all one way. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I'd like to circle back to something that you mentioned when we were talking about children who are not able to be vaccinated and the effects of COVID. In March, you wrote a story about a long-haul COVID sufferer. And these are people with symptoms that linger for a year, sometimes more. One of my family members is struggling with this right now. I will share that. So what are you hearing about that? I'd like to hear about that story and are we seeing more of that long haul COVID?
Sure. Well, COVID is a really weird disease, Shireen. Like it really is. There's a lot that we don't understand about it. And one of the weird things about it is that something like 20% of cases, a very, very rough estimate, have these lingering symptoms that last months after infection, sometimes months and months and months after. Now, intuitively, you might think that, well, that might apply to the people who had the very worst cases of COVID, who were in the hospital, and it takes them months to get better. And there are some of those. That is part of it. But it's not really... That's not really the whole story. Most long COVID cases are people who did not have the very most serious cases in the sort of acute phase of the disease. But what happened was they have the symptoms, loss of taste and smell, trouble catching their breath, tachycardia, where your heart starts racing. These symptoms just never went away for something like 20% of these people. There was a big study in the UK of 20,000 cases of people who had long COVID, and there's like some gradual decline over 20 weeks or more, but it's just really slight. I did a profile of someone who had dealt with long COVID. I also did a story. There was a sort of a moment of hope earlier this year, when some people were reporting that that getting vaccinated caused their long COVID symptoms to go away or to improve. And that is a real thing. I talked to some people who experienced that themselves. That is being studied, but unfortunately, in the months that have followed, it does not seem to be especially widespread. It is not a miracle cure. I will say, and this is probably important to say, just last night I was looking at a study that showed that people who were vaccinated and contracted COVID-19, which can happen, are much, much, much less likely, like 50% or more less likely to have long COVID symptoms. So in that sense, vaccination is going to be effective at lessening this burden on people as well. But of course, that's maybe cold comfort for people like your family member who are dealing with this after getting the disease before being vaccinated.
I know that Marshfield Medical Center implemented a vaccination mandate for all staff, which interestingly, I just learned, trickles down to all vendors who provides goods and services to the organization as well. Aspirus, the other major healthcare provider in our area, has not yet done that. What has the reaction been to that mandate? I know that there was at least one protest in our area.
Sure. Marshfield has, Aspirus hasn't, but also like a bunch of hospitals have. Virtually all nursing homes are there or moving that way. They deal with people who are the very most at risk from COVID-19. And so as you, I guess, would expect, there has been a backlash against some of those mandates. There's been a protest around here. There were protests in Madison. I talked to somebody who participated in one in Green Bay. They're real. And there are, you know, the healthcare sector employs just a huge number of people. There are doctors and nurses, right? But there are CNAs and assistants and janitorial staff,
nutritional workers.
So many people, right? And so it's a very big sector. It's a lot of people. And guess what? Within that universe, there are some people who feel strongly that they don't want to get the COVID vaccine. I think it will be interesting to see, because the places have tended to set their deadlines for getting the vaccine in maybe October, end of September, something like that. And it'll be interesting to see whether they actually start firing people, or if they maybe extend that deadline, or they offer accommodation. You just have to wear more PPE, or I don't know. And it's a tough one. I think, to be quite fair to healthcare organizations, it's a tough one because they are struggling with staffing. They are understaffed in most cases, and I'm sure they don't want to fire people, but they also have a obligation to try to keep their patients safe.
Sure. We have a caller, Mary from Lac du Flambeau, is on the line. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, one thing I haven't heard reported on is the housing situation up here in northern Wisconsin. And you hear a lot about employers up here who can't find people to work. And you have driven up wages here, which is great. But, there's a lot of talk about, well, you know, people are getting that extra money from the government and they don't want to work. And, you know, I think it's a deeper issue than that. I don't know anybody up here who is doing that. But if especially a young person, I mean, it's a wonderful place to live up here. And if a young person wants to move up here, there's jobs, and they're year-round jobs. These aren't seasonal. There's no place for them to live. There's nothing to rent. I looked in our local flyer the other day under those column for things for rent, and there were no ads except for an ad from a person who was looking for a place to live. And I see this on the social media that I follow up here too, that people are constantly posting that they're looking for a place to live and they can't find it. And people who are, you know, they've come up here to work and they're going to leave the area because they can't find any housing.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. And Rob, I'm curious what you're hearing about that too, because we were just talking to some people who live in Minocqua who say the same thing, that they could find workers, but their workers can't find a place to live.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's very real. And I have talked to some municipalities, people, you know, economic development organizations that are trying to work on this problem. But like, it's a hard problem, right? So rural Wisconsin has not seen the type of population declines that some other rural parts of the U.S. have seen. It's held relatively steady, but it's not rapidly growing. And so from the point of view of like housing developers, it can be a hard sell to say that you need to build a bunch of units. But there's like this, it's like this vicious cycle that's set up where if it's not perceived as a good place to build housing, then this problem that Mary describes, which is very real, is seen where if somebody wanted to move there, there's no place to move, or it's a real challenge. They have to live far away and commute these like far distances through the Northwoods to get to their, you know, job at the paper mill or whatever, their job at the sawmill. And it's not a problem that has an easy solution, I don't think, but it is a real issue.
I want to bring up Wisconsin Public Radio's question portal, Wisconsin. It invites readers and listeners to submit questions about the state and its people and culture, and people can pretty much ask anything on the portal. How do you go about finding the answer when you get those questions, Rob?
Sure. You sort of get different types of questions through the Wisconsin portal. There are questions that are factual questions, right? That have answers that we can research. And sometimes that leads to a story. Sometimes you just email somebody back and say, like, here's the answer. Where can I get a vaccine is a question that like we have gotten through the Wisconsin portal. And it's like, here's the answer. You can go to, here's the spot in your town. Another type of question that comes through the Wisconsin question is what you might call more of a comment than a question.
Sure.
Just somebody who has a point they want to make. And of course, we're happy to have that feedback. But also, like, it's a measure of what is on people's minds and where people's maybe anxieties are. People ask about the end of the eviction moratorium. People ask about the pandemic, and it's a way that we can get some feedback and try to answer people's questions, but also like have an understanding of what people care about.
So what were a couple of the biggest questions? You wrote an explainer about this just a few days ago that was really interesting.
Sure. So I took a slice of the questions that we had received that were about the Delta variant of COVID-19. What makes it more contagious? You always hear it's more contagious, and also about booster shots, which are, you know, somewhat controversial move that the Biden administration has made, or not without controversy, to say that they're going to be rolling out booster shots, and like, why are they doing that? Will I have to get one? I talked to a listener named Terry Cummings, and he wrote a question about the Delta variant. He lives in Rhinelander and is in his 60s, and he said something that I found kind of relatable. I have a little bit of tape from my conversation with him.
I'm following all the rules, and basically I've had quite a restriction in my lifestyle because of following the rules. I'm trying to do my best to end this thing.
And that's, I mean, like, I feel that, you know what I mean? He had a sense that he wanted to do what was right. And so his question was based on, like, what does he need to do that?
Interesting. Rob Menser, rural communities reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio, is our guest today as we take a look at the stories that are having the greatest impact on residents in north central Wisconsin. We'd like to hear from you. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guest today is Wisconsin Public Radio Rural Communities reporter Rob Menser. He's here to give a behind-the-scenes look at the reporting process and discuss the top stories making headlines today. We'd like to hear your thoughts, too. You can email route51@wpr.org or call us at 780-974-2. Last month, Democratic U.S. Representative Ron Kind said he won't seek re-election in 2022. Did that take you by surprise?
Yes. Surprised. I mean, maybe not shocked. Ron Kind had a really tough re-election race in 2020. He's been a congressman for a long time in southwestern Wisconsin. And his district has become more conservative. It's a rural district. It's a place where Donald Trump did extremely well in 2016. And he had a serious challenge that it was a well-funded challenge in 2020. But he won. He ran well ahead of Joe Biden in the district and won re-election. However, as we know from history, the first midterms are tough for the president's party. And his district for sure was going to be heavily, heavily targeted by Republicans. And in this case, he made the decision to retire rather than sort of go forward with that race.
Is there going to be a change in that district with the latest census numbers and redistricting efforts? Do you think that district will lean more Democratic in the future, or is it about the same?
Yeah, so this is so interesting. It's, of course, it's impossible to know for sure. We will know when the maps come out. We'll know when the legal battle about the maps is finally complete. But here's what we know. So in if you permit me a brief history lesson, in the 2010 redistricting, the district became more significantly more Democratic by the new lines that were drawn. And now, why was that the case? The reason was because the Republicans who led that redistricting effort wanted to ensure that the 7th congressional district would be competitive for a Republican to win. The 7th congressional district, which is the Northwoods and Wausau, and a lot of northwestern Wisconsin. And they did that. They did make the 7th district more Republican by cutting out, for instance, Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, and Chippewa Falls, putting them in Ron Kind's district, creating what looked at the time like a fairly safe Democratic district for Ron Kind. Now, what's happened since then is the 7th district has become super Republican, and the 3rd district, where Ron Kind has represented, has sort of become steadily more Republican to the point that it's kind of like leaning Republican now. Now, finally, to get to your actual question, which is in the latest census, what happened in the latest census is Dane County grew like absolute gangbusters. Madison itself, but also rural Dane County, which is very, very Democratic, right? And so Dane County will for sure get a new assembly representative, for example, as a result of that. But the other thing is some of those largely Democratic voters who are now in a Democratic district that includes Madison will very likely end up in the 3rd congressional district, which is this competitive district. So yes, it really looks like that district is going to become somewhat more Democratic with redistricting. The question is, will it be enough to turn it from a sort of lean Republican district to a true toss-up? And I do not know the answer to that.
Well, Wisconsin is really unique that we have a Democratic governor, a Republican majority in the legislature. What about that makeup? Do you think that will change as a result of any redistricting, or won't that have an effect?
No. So there are a couple of things, and my colleagues have been hard at work on a longer term project about redistricting in Wisconsin, and there's many things going on. So federal courts have found, as a matter of objective fact, that the 2010 maps were a gerrymander. They absolutely objectively favored Republicans. They were drawn that way. But that's not the only thing. That's not the only factor. It's not the only thing that's gone on, because the other fact about Wisconsin is that it has two extremely Democratic population centers in Madison and Milwaukee, and rural areas have become more Republican over time. And so there's almost no map where Democrats would be able to take control of the legislature, because the reason is their Madison districts, their Milwaukee districts are voting 80% for Democrats, 90% for Democrats. And so all those Democratic votes are so concentrated that that you end up with more, numerically more conservative leaning districts.
Lots of partisan struggles at the state level, for sure. And one that we've been hearing a lot about in the last couple of weeks involves Wisconsin's Natural Resources Board. Fred Prain, a dentist in Wausau, is refusing to step down. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is kind of a weird one. So the Natural Resources Board has oversight of a number of environmental policies, and the definitely the most salient one in the political universe is the wolf hunt. This is like, you know, an extremely charged issue. And one of the ways that it's charged is by debating how many wolves should be included in the wolf hunt if Wisconsin's going to do one. And Fred Prain has a view on that. His term has expired. But the Wisconsin Senate has not confirmed his replacement. So his position is that he is free to stay on that board and take part in these positions for until that replacement is confirmed. And then the sort of like unspoken second part is the Senate might just not confirm that person. They can do it forever. We don't know, right? We just don't know. This, as you might expect, has made allies of the governor and of the new appointment outraged, and they say that it's they're working the system, they're cheating here.
Sure, and a number of lawsuits as well. Josh Call announced a lawsuit to try to remove Prain, and some other organizations have had some pretty strong words about this as well.
Right. So when it first came out, it was sort of like this is legal, but highly unusual. It's a violation of norms, but maybe not laws. But then there has been questioned, and right, the state attorney general has taken up that point. My colleague Danielle Kading spoke with Prain. This is a few months ago, but it's relevant. She spoke with him after the Humane Society had written a letter calling on the Attorney General to take action to remove him from the board.
There's no reason the Humane Society would write such a letter unless they were desperately opposed to me being present in the August meeting where the NRB sets quota for the wolf hunt for this fall. There's a clear correlation between the two, and I think the public has to clearly understand that.
Very interesting.
Yeah, there is a clear correlation. I don't see another way to say it. It is the case that the Humane Society cared about that most because he would be involved in setting the wolf hunt quota. And then, in fact, he was at the Argus meeting and he was involved in setting the quota for the wolf hunt at, I think it was 300, well above what the DNR had recommended. So like that is indeed what happened.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and I'm sure you'll be continuing to watch that. Let's shift over to a conversation about Afghanistan and the refugees there. The U.S. ended its 20-year war with Afghanistan this week. The last troops just left a few days ago. Tens of thousands of refugees, Afghan people who helped the U.S. during the war, are now in the United States. How many are coming to Fort McCoy? Do we have a sense of that? And what's the reaction been to that plan?
Sure. We do have a sense of it. It's I think that the latest number is there are around 7,000 refugees at Fort McCoy now. The base has a capacity for 10,000, and I believe it's been reported that that they may expand that up to 13,000. That's a lot of people. That's a little city, you know. You know, certainly many of these refugees have come with nothing but the clothes on their backs. There have been efforts by Catholic charities, by other nonprofits to get, you know, lead donation drives and get them changes of clothes and other basic necessities that they need. They're getting fed at Fort McCoy, and this is where they can stay while their applications are processed and the vetting process is completed by the government. That may result in then resettlement in, could be in U.S. cities. Not all of them will. Some may go to Europe or other countries. But this is like, the idea was they needed to be removed from a place where they were in immediate danger, and Fort McCoy is a place where they can be held in this sort of liminal space that they're in.
What do you know, if anything, about the vetting process? What happens once they get here?
Well, I know that. So the U.S. government does biometric scans, right? So it's not just based on like paper that could be forged, right? They want to. The U.S. government wants to know that these people are who they say they are. But speaking of the reaction to this move, you know, Senator Ron Johnson had a press conference out at Fort McCoy that my colleague Hope Kerwin covered. Representative Mike Gallagher and others have been out there and toured the facility and given statements to the press that are critical of the government's vetting process, or at least raising questions about it. Right. And I think that they see the potential that people will be uncomfortable with how the process has been managed, and they are they're expressing some of those concerns and raising some of those questions.
We have a few minutes left, and I'd like to circle back to something that we were talking about a little bit earlier in the program. We're talking about the Delta variant, and you played a clip from Terry Cummings in Rhinelander with his concerns and about infection rates. And what do we know about the surge of hospitalizations at this time? Or is there a surge, I should say?
Yeah, there's a surge. There's about 1,000 people hospitalized in Wisconsin right now. And you can look back in the early summer, there were many fewer than 100. There were, you know, it's a surge for sure. And I think we can expect that the pattern will follow what followed in some of the southern states, Florida, elsewhere, that saw a big surge as the Delta variant became the dominant strain of COVID-19, which it is in Wisconsin. Delta is more contagious. I mentioned this in the earlier conversation. And the reason for that is it is shaped slightly differently. You've seen these depictions of the coronavirus with these like spikes
round
coming
things,
off of it.
Yes.
Right, yeah. And those spikes in the Delta variant, they have a little bit different shape. And so that means that they are more likely to grab onto your cells. They are better at fighting off your antibodies, and they make people more sick. We know that vaccinated people are much less likely to become sick. They are 5 times less likely to be hospitalized. They are 10 times less likely to die. That is true against the Alpha variant. It's true against the Delta variant. But there are also a lot of people who are not vaccinated in Wisconsin. There are a lot of vulnerable people in all parts of the state. It doesn't take that many people. You know what I mean? Like, if you could say, well, if there are 60% of your county is vaccinated, you feel like you're doing pretty well. And objectively, if there's 70%, maybe you are. But those 30%, that's plenty of people to fill up a hospital. That can absolutely put a strain on the healthcare system. And that is happening now. places have in Wausau, in Green Bay, in Western Wisconsin have reopened COVID wards that had been closed down. They're back to a footing that resembles where they were during Wisconsin's surge last fall. And it's like, they didn't think that they would have to do that again. They didn't want to be back there, but we are back, and the numbers show it's going to be several more weeks of this.
We'll watch for your continued reporting on that and these other issues as well. Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Special thanks to our guest, Wisconsin Public Radio Rural Communities reporter Rob Menser. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, hear a Wausau heart surgeon tell his story about his family's escape from Cuba, and in 2 weeks, a discussion on immigration efforts underway in Wisconsin. Until then, we're heading out of town.